The Soviets took the basic V-2 design and quickly built a series of rockets based on it. Essentially, the entire U.S. and USSR arsenals were based on modifying or lashing together the V-2 rockets, which in turn were based on Goddard's pioneering prototypes. One of the major goals of both the United States and USSR was launching the first artificial satellite. It was Isaac Newton himself who first proposed the concept. In a now famous diagram, Newton noted that if you fire a cannonball from a mountaintop, it will fall near the base of the mountain. Following his equations of motion, however, the faster the cannonball travels, the farther it will go. If you fire the cannonball fast enough, it will circle completely around the Earth and become a satellite. Newton made a historic breakthrough. If you replace this cannonball with the moon, then his equations of motion should be able to predict the precise nature of the moon's orbit. In his cannonball thought experiment, he asked a key question. If an apple falls, does the moon also fall? Since the cannonball is in free fall as it goes around the Earth, the moon must also be in free fall. Newton's insight set into motion one of the greatest revolutions in all of history. Newton could now calculate the motion of cannonballs, moons, planets, almost everything. For example, using his laws of motion, you can easily show that you must fire the cannonball at 18,000 miles per hour in order to have it orbit the Earth. Newton's vision became a reality when the Soviets launched the world's first artificial satellite, Sputnik, in October 1957. Sputnik Age. The immense shock to the American psyche upon learning of Sputnik cannot be underestimated. Americans quickly realized that the Soviets led the world in rocket science. The humiliation was made worse when, 2 months later, the Navy's Vanguard missile suffered a catastrophic failure on international TV. I vividly remember as a child asking my mother if I could stay up and watch the missile launch. She reluctantly agreed. I was horrified to witness the Vanguard missile rise 4 feet into the air, then drop back down 4 feet, tip over, and destroy its own launch pad in a huge, blinding explosion. I could clearly see the nose cone at the top of the missile, which contained the satellite, topple over and disappear in a ball of flames. The humiliation continued when the second Vanguard launch a few months later also failed. The press had a field day, calling the missile Flopnik and Kaputnik. The Soviet UN delegate even joked that Russia should give aid to the United States. Trying to recover from this huge media blow to our national prestige, von Braun was ordered to quickly launch a satellite, Explorer 1, using the Juno 1 missile. The Juno 1 was based on the Redstone rocket, which in turn was based on the V-2. But the Soviets had a series of aces up their sleeve. A sequence of historic firsts dominated the headlines for the next several years. 1957. Sputnik 2 carried the first animal, a dog named Laika, into orbit. 1957, Lunik 1 was the first rocket to fly past the moon. 1959, Lunik 2 was the first to hit the moon. 1959, Lunik 3 was the first rocket to photograph the backside of the moon. 1960, Sputnik 5 had the first animals returned safely from space. 1961, Venera 1 was the first probe to fly past Venus. The Russian space program reached its crowning achievement when Yuri Gagarin safely orbited the Earth in 1961. I distinctly remember those years when Sputnik spread panic throughout the United States. How could a seemingly backward nation, the Soviet Union, suddenly leapfrog ahead of us? Commentators concluded that the root cause of this fiasco was the U.S. education system. American students were falling behind the Soviets, A crash campaign had to be mounted so that money, resources, and media attention could be devoted to producing a new generation of American scientists who could compete with the Russians. Articles at the time declared that Ivan can read, but Johnny cannot. Out of this troubled time came the Sputnik generation, a cohort of students who considered it their national duty to become physicists, chemists, or rocket scientists. Under enormous pressure to let the military wrest control over the U.S. space program from seemingly hapless civilian scientists, President Dwight Eisenhower bravely insisted on continued civilian oversight and created NASA. Then President John F. Kennedy, responding to Gagarin's orbital trip, called for an expedited program to put humans on the moon by the end of the decade. This call galvanized the nation. By 1966, an astounding 5.5% of the U.S. federal budget was going into the lunar program. As always, NASA moved cautiously, perfecting the technology needed to bring a moon landing about in a series of launches. First, there was the one-manned craft called Mercury, and then the two-manned Gemini, and finally the three-manned Apollo. NASA also carefully mastered each step in space travel. First, astronauts left the safety of their spaceships and made the first spacewalks. Then, astronauts mastered the complex art of docking their spaceship with another ship. Next, astronauts orbited completely around the moon, but did not land on the surface. Then, finally, NASA was ready to launch astronauts directly to the moon. Von Braun was called in to help build the Saturn V, which was to be the biggest rocket ever built. This rocket was a truly marvelous engineering masterpiece. It stood 60 feet taller than the Statue of Liberty. It could lift a payload of 310,000 pounds into orbit around the Earth. Most important, it could send large payloads past 25,000 miles per hour, which is the escape velocity of the Earth. The possibility of a fatal disaster was ever on the minds of NASA. President Richard Nixon had two speeches prepared for his TV announcement of the results of the Apollo 11 mission. One speech was to report that the effort was a failure and that American astronauts had died on the moon. This scenario actually came very close to happening. In the final seconds before the lunar module was to land, computer alarms went off inside the capsule. Neil Armstrong manually took control of the spacecraft and gently landed it on the moon. Analysis later showed that they had only 50 seconds of fuel left. The capsule might have crashed. Fortunately, on July 20, 1969, President Nixon was able to deliver the other speech, congratulating our astronauts for their successful landing. Even today, the Saturn V is the only rocket ever to carry humans beyond near-Earth orbit. Surprisingly, it performed flawlessly. A total of 15 Saturn rockets were built, and 13 were flown, without a mishap. Altogether, the Saturn V sent 24 astronauts to either land on or fly by the moon, from December 1968 to December 1972. And the Apollo astronauts were rightly hailed as heroes, who had restored our national reputation. The Russians were also heavily involved in the race to the moon. However, they ran into a number of difficulties. Korolev, who had directed the Soviet rocket program, died in 1966, and there were four failures of the N-1 rocket, which was to take Russian astronauts to the moon. But perhaps most decisive was the fact that the Soviet economy, already stretched by the Cold War, could not compete with the U.S. economy, which was more than twice its size. Lost in Space. I remember the moment that Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin set foot on the moon. It was July 1969, and I was in the U.S. Army, training with the infantry at Fort Lewis, Washington, and wondering if I would be sent to fight in Vietnam. It was thrilling to know that history was being made right before our eyes. But it was also disconcerting to know that if I died on the battlefield, I would not be able to share my memories of the historic moon landing with my future children. After the last launch of the Saturn V in 1972, the American public began to be consumed with other matters. The war on poverty was in full swing, and the Vietnam War was devouring more and more money and lives. Going to the moon seemed like a luxury when Americans were starving next door or dying abroad. The astronomical cost of the space program was unsustainable. Plans were made for the post-Apollo era. Several proposals were on the table. One prioritized sending unmanned rockets into space, an effort led by the military, commercial, and scientific groups that were less interested in heroics and more interested in valuable payloads. Another proposal emphasized sending humans into space. The harsh reality was that it was always easier to get Congress and the taxpayer to fund astronauts into space rather than some nameless space probe. As one congressman summed up, "No Buck Rogers, no bucks." Both groups wanted quick and cheap access to outer space rather than costly missions that were years apart. But the end result was a strange hybrid that pleased no one. Astronauts would be sent along with freight and cargo. The compromise took the form of the Space Shuttle, which began operating in 1981. This craft was an engineering marvel that exploited all the lessons and advanced technologies developed over the past decades. It was capable of sending 60,000 pounds of payload into orbit and then docking with the International Space Station. Unlike the Apollo space modules, which were retired after each flight, the space shuttle was designed to be partially reusable. It was capable of sending 7 astronauts into space and then flying them back home like an airplane. As a result, space travel gradually started to seem routine. Americans became accustomed to seeing astronauts waving at us from their latest visit to the International Space Station, which itself was a compromise between the many nations paying the bills. Over time, problems emerged with the space shuttle. For one, although the shuttle was designed to save money, costs nevertheless began to soar, so that each launch consumed about $1 billion. Sending anything into near-Earth orbit on the shuttle cost roughly $40,000 per pound, which was about 4 times the cost of other delivery systems. Companies complained that it was much cheaper to send their satellites using conventional rockets. Secondly, flights took place infrequently, with many months between launches. Even the U.S. Air Force was frustrated by these limitations and eventually canceled some of its space shuttle launches in favor of using other options. Physicist Freeman Dyson of the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey, has his own thoughts on why the space shuttle failed to live up to expectations. When we look at the history of the railroad, we see that it initially started as a carrier for all goods, including humans and commercial products. The commercial side and consumer side of the industry each had their own distinct priorities and concerns, and they eventually split apart, increasing efficiency and lowering costs. The space shuttle, however, never made this split, and remained a cross between commercial and consumer interests. Instead of being everything to everyone, it became nothing to nobody, especially with its cost overruns and flight delays. And matters worsened after the Challenger and Columbia tragedies, which cost the lives of 14 brave astronauts. These disasters weakened public, private, and government support for the space program. As physicists James and Gregory Benford wrote, Congress came to see NASA primarily as a jobs program, not an exploratory agency. They also observed that very little useful science got done in the space station. The station was about camping in space, not living in space. Without the wind of the Cold War in its sails, the space program rapidly lost funding and momentum. Back in the heyday of the Apollo space program, The joke was that NASA could go to Congress asking for funds and say just one word, Russia. Then Congress would whip out its checkbook and reply, how much? But those days were long gone. As Isaac Asimov said, we scored a touchdown, and then we took our football and went home. Things finally came to a head in 2011, when former President Barack Obama ordered a new Valentine's Day massacre. In one sweeping gesture, he canceled the Constellation program, the replacement for the shuttle, the Moon program, and the Mars program. To relieve the tax burden on the public, he defunded these programs in hope that the private sector would make up the difference. 20,000 veterans of the space program were suddenly laid off, throwing away the collective wisdom of NASA's best and brightest. The greatest humiliation was that American astronauts, after going toe-to-toe with Russian astronauts for decades, would now be forced to hitchhike on Russian booster rockets. The heyday of space exploration, it seemed, was over. Things had reached rock bottom. The problem could be summed up in one four-letter word. Cost. It takes $10,000 to put a pound of anything in near-Earth orbit. Imagine your body made of solid gold. That's roughly what it would take to put you into orbit. To put something on the moon can easily cost $100,000 per pound. And to put things on Mars costs upward of $1 million per pound. Estimates of putting an astronaut on Mars are often between $400 and $500 billion in total. I live in New York City. For me, it was a sad day when the space shuttle came to town. Although curious tourists lined up and cheered as the shuttle came rolling down the street, it represented the end of an era. The ship was put on display, eventually resting off the pier on 42nd Street. With no replacement in sight, it felt as if we were giving up on science, and hence, our future. Looking back at those dark days, I am sometimes reminded of what happened to the great Chinese imperial fleet in the 15th century. Back then, the Chinese were the undisputed leaders in science and exploration. They invented gunpowder, the compass, and the printing press. They were unparalleled in military power and technology. Meanwhile, medieval Europe was racked by religious wars and mired in inquisitions, witch trials, and superstition. And great scientists and visionaries like Giordano Bruno and Galileo were often either burned alive or placed under house arrest, their works banned. Europe, at the time, was a net importer of technology, not a source of innovation. The Chinese emperor launched, under the command of Admiral Zheng He, the most ambitious naval expedition of all time, with 28,000 sailors on a fleet of 317 huge ships, each one 5 times longer than the ships of Columbus. The world would not see anything like it for another 400 years. Not once, but 7 times, from 1405 to 1433, Admiral Zheng He sailed across the known world, around Southeast Asia and past the Middle East, eventually ending up in East Africa. There are ancient woodcuts of the strange animals, like giraffes, that he brought back from his voyages of discovery being paraded before the court. But when the emperor passed away, the new rulers decided that they had no use for exploration and discovery. They even decreed that a Chinese citizen could not own a boat. The fleet itself was left to rot or allowed to burn, and records of Admiral Zheng He's great accomplishments were suppressed. Succeeding emperors effectively cut off contact between China and the rest of the world. China turned inward, with disastrous results, eventually leading to decay, total collapse, chaos, civil war, and revolution. I sometimes think about how easy it is for a nation to slip into complacency and ruin after decades of basking in the sun. Since science is the engine of prosperity, Nations that turn their backs on science and technology eventually enter a downward spiral. The U.S. space program similarly fell into decline. But now the political and economic circumstances are changing. A new cast of characters is taking center stage. Daring astronauts are being replaced by dashing billionaire entrepreneurs. New ideas, new energy, and new funding are driving this renaissance. But can this combination of private funds and government financing pave the way to the heavens? Yours is the light by which my spirit's born. You are my sun, my moon, and all my stars. E.E. Cummings. Chapter 2. New Golden Age of Space Travel. Unlike the decline of China's naval fleet, which lasted for centuries, the U.S. manned space program is experiencing a revival, after only a few decades of neglect. A variety of factors is turning the tide. One is the influx of resources from Silicon Valley entrepreneurs. A rare combination of private funding and governmental financing is making possible a new generation of rockets. At the same time, the falling cost of space travel allows a range of projects to become feasible. Public support for space travel is also reaching a tipping point. As Americans again warm up to Hollywood movies and TV specials about space exploration. And most important, NASA has finally regained its focus. On October 8, 2015, after years of muddle, vacillation, and indecision, NASA finally declared its long-term goal, to send astronauts to Mars. NASA even sketched out a rough set of goals for itself, beginning with returning to the moon. Rather than a final destination, though, the moon would be a stepping stone for the more ambitious goal of reaching Mars. The once rudderless agency suddenly had a direction. Analysts hailed this decision, concluding that NASA was once again claiming the mantle of leadership in space exploration. So first, let us discuss our nearest celestial neighbor, the moon, and then travel outward into deep space. Going back to the moon. The backbone of NASA's effort to return to the moon is a combination of the Space Launch System, SLS Heavy Booster Rocket, and the Orion Space Module. Both of them are orphans of President Obama's budget cuts of the early 2010s, when he canceled the Constellation program. But NASA was able to salvage the space module of the Constellation, the Orion capsule, as well as the SLS Heavy Booster Rocket, which was still in the planning stage. Originally from entirely different missions, they were cobbled together to create NASA's basic launch system. Currently, the SLS Orion rocket is scheduled to conduct a manned lunar flyby in the mid-2020s. The first thing you notice about the SLS Orion system is that it does not look anything like its immediate predecessor, the Space Shuttle. It does, however, resemble the Saturn V rocket. For about 45 years, the Saturn V rocket has been a museum piece. But in some sense, it is now being resurrected as the SLS booster rocket. Seeing the SLS Orion brings on a sense of déjà vu. The SLS can carry a payload of 130 tons. It is also 322 feet tall, comparable to the Saturn V rocket. The astronauts, instead of sitting in a ship on the side of the booster rocket, like they did on the space shuttle, are in a capsule perched directly on top of the booster rocket, like the Apollo spacecraft was on the Saturn V. The SLS Orion, unlike the space shuttle, is dedicated to carrying mainly astronauts and not cargo. In addition, the SLS Orion is not designed to merely reach near-Earth orbit. Instead, like the Saturn V, it is designed to attain Earth escape velocity. The Orion capsule is designed to carry 4 to 6 crew members, while the Apollo capsule of the Saturn V only held 3. Like the Apollo capsule, the Orion capsule is cramped inside. It is 16 feet in diameter and 11 feet tall and weighs 57,000 pounds. Since space is at a premium, astronauts have historically been small people. Yuri Gagarin, for example, was only 5 feet 2 inches tall. And unlike the Saturn V rocket, which was specifically designed to go to the moon, the SLS rocket can take you almost anywhere. To the moon, the asteroids, and even Mars. We also have the billionaires who are tired of the lumbering pace of NASA bureaucrats and want to send astronauts to the moon and even Mars relatively soon. These young entrepreneurs were lured by former President Obama's proposal to have private enterprise take over the manned space program. Defenders of NASA claim that its cautious pace is due to NASA's safety concerns. In the wake of the 2 space shuttle disasters, congressional hearings almost caused the space program to shut down entirely amid strong public disapproval. Another disaster of that scope could put an end to the program. Also, they point out that in the 1990s, NASA tried adopting the mantra, faster, better, cheaper. However, when the Mars Observer was lost in 1993 due to a ruptured fuel tank, just as it was about to orbit Mars, many thought that NASA might have rushed the mission, and the faster, better, cheaper slogan was quietly dropped. So one has to strike a delicate balance between the hotheads who want an accelerated pace and the bureaucrats who are gun-shy about safety and the cost of failure. Nevertheless, 2 billionaires have taken the lead in fast-tracking the space program. Jeff Bezos, founder of Amazon and owner of the Washington Post, and Elon Musk, founder of PayPal, Tesla, and SpaceX. The press is already dubbing it the Battle of the Billionaires. Both Bezos and Musk would like to shift humanity into outer space. While Musk is taking the long view and setting his sights on Mars, Bezos has a more immediate vision of going to the moon. To the moon. People from all over have flocked to Florida, hoping to catch a glimpse of the first capsule that will take our astronauts to the moon. The lunar capsule will carry 3 astronauts on a voyage unprecedented in human history, an encounter with another celestial body. The journey to the moon will take about 3 days, and the astronauts will experience things never felt before, such as weightlessness. After a heroic voyage, the ship will splash down safely in the Pacific Ocean, and its passengers will be celebrated as heroes, opening up a new chapter in world history. All the calculations have been done using Newton's laws, ensuring a precise voyage. But there is one problem. It's actually a tale written by Jules Verne in his prophetic novel, From the Earth to the Moon, published in 1865, just after the end of the Civil War. The organizers of the moonshot are not NASA scientists, but members of the Baltimore Gun Club. What is truly remarkable is that Jules Verne, writing more than 100 years before the first lunar landing, was able to predict so many features of the actual moonshot. He was able to correctly portray the size of the capsule, the location of the launch, and the method of landing back on Earth. The only major flaw in his book was the use of a gigantic cannon to send the astronauts to the moon. The sudden acceleration of the gunshot would be about 20,000 times the force of gravity, which would certainly kill anyone aboard the ship. However, before the coming of liquid-fueled rockets, Verne had no other way to envision the journey. Verne also postulated that the astronauts would become weightless, but only at one point, midway between the moon and the Earth. He did not realize that the astronauts would become weightless throughout their voyage. Even today, commentators make mistakes about weightlessness, sometimes stating that it is caused by the absence of gravity in space. Actually, there is plenty of gravity in space, enough to whip giant planets like Jupiter around the sun. The experience of weightlessness is caused by the fact that everything falls at the same rate. So an astronaut inside the spaceship would fall at the same rate as his ship and experience the illusion that gravity has been turned off. Today, it is not the private fortunes of the members of the Baltimore Gun Club fueling this new space race, but the checkbooks of moguls like Jeff Bezos. Instead of waiting for NASA to give him permission to build rockets and a launch pad with taxpayer dollars, he founded his own company, Blue Origin, and is building them himself, with his own pocket money. Already, the project has gone beyond the planning stage. Blue Origin has produced its own rocket system, called New Shepard, named after Alan Shepard, the first American to go into space via a suborbital rocket. In fact, the New Shepard rocket was the first suborbital rocket in the world to successfully land back on its original launch pad, just beating out Elon Musk's Falcon rocket, which was the first reusable rocket to actually send a payload into Earth orbit. Bezos' New Shepard rocket is only suborbital, meaning that it cannot reach a speed of 18,000 miles per hour and go into near-Earth orbit. It won't take us to the moon, but it may be the first American rocket to routinely offer tourists a view of space. Blue Origin recently released a video of a hypothetical journey on the New Shepard, and it looked like you were riding first class on a luxury ship. When you enter the space capsule, you are immediately impressed with how roomy it is. Far from the cramped quarters often seen in science fiction movies, there is ample room for you and five other tourists to be strapped into your lush reclining seats, where you immediately sink into black leather. You can look out of huge windows that are approximately 2.4 feet wide and 3.5 feet tall. Every seat is a window seat, the largest windows ever in space, Bezos claims. Space travel has never been so gorgeous. Because you are about to enter outer space, there are some precautions you must take. 2 days before the trip, you fly into Van Horn, Texas, where Blue Origin has its launch facility. There you meet your fellow tourists and hear short talks by the crew. Since the voyage is completely automated, the crew members do not ride along with the tourists. Your instructor explains that the entire trip will take 11 minutes as you soar vertically, 62 miles straight up, reaching the boundary between the atmosphere and outer space. Outside, the sky will turn dark purple and then inky black. Once the capsule reaches outer space, you can unbuckle your seat and experience 4 minutes of weightlessness. You will then float like an acrobat, free of the earthly constraints of gravity. Some people get sick and vomit while experiencing weightlessness, but this won't be a problem, the instructor claims, since the trip is so short. For training astronauts, NASA employs the Vomit Comet, which is a KC-135 airplane that can simulate weightlessness. The Vomit Comet rises steeply, suddenly shuts off its engines for about 30 seconds, and then falls back down. The astronauts are now like a rock thrown in the air. They are in free fall. When the airplane turns on its engines, the astronauts fall back to the floor. This process is repeated for several hours. At the end of the New Shepard trip, the capsule releases parachutes and then gently lands back on the ground using its own rockets. There is no need for a splashdown in the ocean. And unlike the space shuttle, it has a safety system so that you can be ejected from the rocket if there is a misfire during launch. The Space Shuttle Challenger did not have such an ejection system, and 7 astronauts died. Blue Origin has not yet released the price tag for this suborbital trip into space, but analysts think initially it could be in the neighborhood of $200,000 per passenger. This is the price of a trip on a rival suborbital rocket being developed by Richard Branson, another billionaire who has made his mark in the annals of space exploration. Branson is the founder of Virgin Atlantic Airways and Virgin Galactic, and he is backing the efforts of aerospace engineer Burt Rutan. In 2004, Rutan's Spaceship One made headlines when it won the $10 million Ansari X Prize. Spaceship One was able to reach the boundary of the atmosphere 70 miles above the Earth. Although Spaceship Two suffered a fatal accident in 2014 when flying above the Mojave Desert, Branson plans to continue testing the rocket and make space tourism a reality. Time will tell which rocket system will succeed commercially, But it seems clear that space tourism is here to stay. Bezos is producing yet another rocket that will send people into Earth orbit. It is the new Glenn rocket, named after astronaut John Glenn, the first American to orbit the Earth. The rocket will have up to three stages, stand 313 feet tall, and generate 3.8 million pounds of thrust. Although the new Glenn rocket is still being designed, Bezos has dropped hints that he is planning an even more advanced rocket, to be called the new Armstrong, which may go beyond Earth orbit and all the way to the moon. When he was a child, Bezos dreamed of going into outer space, mainly with the crew of the Enterprise on Star Trek. He would participate in plays based on the TV series, taking on the roles of Spock, Captain Kirk, and even the computer. Upon his high school graduation, a time when most teenagers might fantasize about their first car or the senior prom, he laid out a visionary plan for the next century. He said he wanted to build space hotels, amusement parks, yachts, and colonies for 2 or 3 million people orbiting around the Earth. The whole idea is to preserve the Earth. The goal is to be able to evacuate humans. The planet would become a park, he wrote. As Bezos saw it, the polluting industrial output of the planet could eventually be moved into space. To put his money where his mouth is, as an adult, he founded the company Blue Origin to build the rockets of the future. The name of his rocket company refers to the planet Earth, which can be seen as a blue sphere from outer space. The aim is to open up space travel to paying customers. The vision for Blue is pretty simple, he says. We want to see millions of people living and working in space. That's going to take a long time, but I think it's a worthwhile goal. In 2017, he announced a short-term plan for Blue Origin to set up a delivery system for the moon. He envisions a vast operation that, just as Amazon rapidly ships out a variety of products at the click of a button, could deliver machinery, building supplies, and goods and services to the moon. Once considered a lonely outpost in space, the moon would become a bustling industrial and commercial hub with permanent manned bases and manufacturing. This loose talk about cities on the moon might normally be dismissed as the ravings of an eccentric. But when it comes from one of the richest people on Earth, who has the ear of the President, Congress, and the editors of the Washington Post, one takes it all quite seriously. Permanent moon base. To help pay for these ambitious projects, astronomers have looked into the physics and economics of mining the moon and noted at least three potential resources worth exploiting. In the 1990s, an unexpected discovery caught scientists by surprise: the presence of large quantities of ice in the southern hemisphere of the moon. There, in the shadows of large mountain ranges and craters, is a perpetual darkness that is below freezing. The origin of this ice is probably cometary impacts in the early history of the solar system. Comets are mainly made of ice, dust, and rock, so any comet that strikes the moon in one of these shadows might leave a deposit of water and ice. The water, in turn, can be turned into oxygen and hydrogen, which happen to be the principal components of rocket fuel. This could turn the moon into a cosmic gas station. The water could also be purified for drinking purposes or used to create small-scale agricultural farms. In fact, another group of Silicon Valley entrepreneurs has created a company called Moon Express to begin the process of mining ice from the moon. It is the first company ever to get permission from the government to begin this commercial enterprise. The preliminary target for Moon Express is, however, more modest. The company will begin by putting a lunar rover on the moon that will systematically search for the presence of ice deposits. The company has already raised enough money through private funding to proceed with this mission. With the financing in place, All systems are go. Scientists have analyzed the moon rocks brought back by the Apollo astronauts and believe there may be other economically significant elements on the moon. Rare earth elements are crucial for the electronics industry, but are mostly found in China. Rare earths are located everywhere in small quantities, but the Chinese rare earth industry makes up 97% of the world trade. China has roughly 30% of the world's reserves. A few years ago, an international trade war almost erupted when Chinese suppliers abruptly raised prices on these key elements, and the world suddenly realized that China had a near monopoly. It is estimated that the supply will begin to be depleted in the coming decades, making it urgent to find alternate sources. Rare earths have been found in moon rocks, so one day it may be cost-effective to extract them from the moon. Platinum is another important element for the electronics industry, and the presence of platinum-like minerals, perhaps left over from ancient asteroid impacts, has also been detected on the moon. Finally, there is the possibility of finding helium-3, which is useful in fusion reactions. When hydrogen atoms are combined at the extremely high temperatures found in these reactions, the hydrogen nuclei fuse, creating helium, plus large amounts of energy and heat. This excess energy is useful to power machines. However, this process also produces copious quantities of neutrons, which are dangerous. The advantage of the fusion process involving helium-3 is that it instead releases an excess proton, which can be handled more easily and deflected by electromagnetic fields. Fusion reactors are still highly experimental, and so far, none exist on Earth. But if they are successfully developed, helium-3 could be mined from the moon to supply fuel for the fusion reactors of the future. But this also raises a tricky point. Is it legal to mine the moon? Or to stake a claim there? In 1967, the United States, Soviet Union, and many other nations signed the Outer Space Treaty, which banned nations from claiming ownership of celestial bodies like the moon. It banned nuclear weapons from Earth orbit and from being placed on the moon or elsewhere in space. The testing of these weapons was also prohibited. The Outer Space Treaty, the first and only one of its kind, holds to this day. However, the treaty said nothing about private ownership of land or the use of the moon for commercial activities, probably because those who drafted it didn't believe private individuals would ever be able to reach the moon. But these matters must be addressed soon, especially now that the price of space travel is dropping and billionaires want to commercialize outer space. The Chinese have announced that they will put their astronauts on the moon by 2025. If they plant their flag, it will largely be symbolic. But what happens if some private developer stakes a claim to the moon after arriving on his or her private spaceship? Once these technical and political issues are settled, the next question is, what will it be like to actually live on the moon? Living on the moon. Our original astronauts only spent brief periods of time on the moon, usually a few days. To create the first manned outposts, future astronauts would have to spend extended time there. They would need to adjust to lunar conditions, which, as you can imagine, are quite different from the Earth's. One factor that limits how long our astronauts can stay on the moon is the availability of food, water, and air, since they would exhaust the supplies that they carry with them within a matter of weeks. In the beginning, everything would have to be shipped from the Earth. Unmanned lunar probes would have to be sent every few weeks to resupply the station. These shipments would become a lifeline for the astronauts, so any accident involving them could present an emergency. Once a moon base is constructed, even a temporary one, one of the first endeavors for the astronauts might be to create oxygen for breathing and for growing their own food. There are a number of chemical reactions that can produce oxygen, and the presence of water creates a ready supply. And this water could also be used in hydroponic gardens to grow crops. Fortunately, communication with the Earth would not pose much of a problem, since it only takes a little more than a second for a radio signal to reach the Earth from the Moon. Apart from a slight delay, astronauts would be able to use their cell phones and the Internet like they do on Earth, so they could be in constant contact with their loved ones and receive the latest news. Initially, our astronauts would have to live inside the space capsule. When they venture out, the first order of business would be to unfurl large solar panels to harvest energy. Since one lunar day corresponds to one Earth month, any sight on the Moon has 2 weeks of daylight followed by 2 weeks of darkness. So they would need large banks of batteries to store the electrical energy harvested during the 2 week day for use during the long night that follows. Once on the Moon, the astronauts might want to travel to the poles for several reasons. There are peaks in the polar regions where the sun never sets, so a solar farm with thousands of solar panels could create a steady supply of energy without interruption. The astronauts might also take advantage of the deposits of ice in the shadows of large mountain ranges and craters at the poles. It is estimated that 600 million metric tons of ice may be found in the northern polar region, in a layer that is several yards thick. Once mining operations begin, much of this ice could be harvested and purified for drinking purposes, as well as for oxygen. It is also possible to mine the soil of the Moon, which contains a surprising amount of oxygen. In fact, there are about 100 pounds of oxygen for every 1,000 pounds of lunar soil. The astronauts would have to adjust to the lower gravity on the Moon. According to Newton's theory of gravity, the amount of gravity on any planet is related to its mass. The Moon's gravity is 1/6 that of Earth's. This means that moving heavy machinery would be much easier on the Moon, and the escape velocity is much lower. So rockets could both land and take off from the Moon rather easily. In the future, a busy spaceport on the Moon is a distinct possibility. But our astronauts would have to relearn simple movements, such as walking. Apollo astronauts realized that walking on the Moon was quite awkward. They found that the fastest way to maneuver was to hop. Because of the Moon's lower gravity, you can hop much farther than taking a step, and it's easier to control your motion. Another issue to contend with is radiation. For missions lasting a few days, it does not pose a major problem. But if the astronauts spend months on the Moon, they could accumulate enough exposure to seriously increase their risk of getting cancer. Simple medical problems could easily escalate into life-threatening situations on the Moon. All of the astronauts would have to have first aid training, and a few of them would probably be medical doctors. If, for example, an astronaut has a heart attack or appendicitis on the Moon, most likely the doctor would set up a teleconferencing session with specialists on Earth, who would perhaps perform surgery by remote control. Robots could be brought in to do various forms of microsurgery, guided by skillful hands back on Earth. The astronauts would need daily weather reports from astronomers monitoring solar activity. Instead of indicating upcoming thunderstorms, these weather reports would give warning of huge solar flares that send hot plumes of radiation into space. If there is a giant eruption on the sun, the astronauts could be signaled to seek cover. Once the warning is given, astronauts would have several hours before a deadly rain of charged subatomic particles hits the base. One way to create shelter from radiation might be to dig an underground base within a lava tube on the Moon. These tubes, remnants of ancient volcanoes, can be huge, up to 1,000 feet across, and would provide adequate protection from radiation from the sun and outer space. Once the astronauts have erected the temporary shelter, large shipments of machinery and supplies would have to be sent from the Earth to begin construction of the permanent moon base. Shipping prefabricated materials and inflatable items could speed up this process. In the movie 2001, astronauts live in huge modern underground lunar bases, which contain landing platforms for rockets and serve as headquarters to coordinate lunar mining operations. Our first lunar headquarters may not be as comprehensive, but the vision presented in the movie may be realized before too long. In building these underground bases, inevitably, you will want the ability to manufacture and repair machine parts. Although large equipment such as bulldozers and cranes would have to be sent from the Earth, 3D printers could fabricate small plastic machine parts on site. Ideally, factories would be established to forge metal. But building a blast furnace is impossible, since there is no air to feed the furnace. However, experiments have shown that lunar soil, when heated by microwaves, can be melted and fused to make rock-hard ceramic bricks, which could be the basic building blocks for the entire moon base. In principle, all of the infrastructure could be made of this material, which can be harvested directly from the soil. Lunar recreation, entertainment. Lastly, there has to be a source of entertainment for the astronauts, a way to blow off steam and relax. When Apollo 14 landed on the moon in 1971, NASA officials did not know that Commander Alan Shepard had secretly smuggled a 6-iron golf club into the space capsule. They were surprised when he proceeded to take out the club and hit a golf ball 200 yards on the lunar surface. This was the first and only time someone engaged in a sports activity on another celestial body. A replica of the golf club is now in the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. Lunar sports would pose a particular challenge due to the lack of air and low gravity. But they will also give rise to some remarkable feats. On Apollo 15, 16, and 17, our astronauts rode the lunar roving vehicles over the dusty surface, each traveling between 17 and 22 miles. Not only was this a valuable scientific mission, it was also a thrilling expedition as they looked out at majestic craters and mountain ranges, knowing that they were the first people ever to see these stunning sights. In the future, riding dune buggies will not only accelerate the survey of the lunar surface, the installation of solar panels, and the construction of the first lunar station, it will serve as a type of recreation. It may perhaps even make possible the first races on the moon. Lunar tourism and exploration could become popular recreational activities as people discover the wonders of an alien landscape. Given the low gravity, hikers would be able to trek over long distances without tiring. Mountain climbers would be able to rappel down steep mountainsides with little effort. And from the top of craters and mountain ranges, they would have an unprecedented panorama of the lunar landscape, literally untouched for billions of years. Spelunkers, who love to explore caves, will be excited to investigate the network of gigantic lava tubes crisscrossing the moon. On the Earth, caves were carved out by underground rivers and contain evidence of ancient water flows in the form of stalactites and stalagmites. But on the moon, there are no appreciable deposits of liquid water. The moon's caves were instead carved out of the rock by molten lava flows. They would look completely different from the caverns we see on Earth. Where did the moon come from? Once mining operations successfully exploit the resources found on the surface of the moon, we will inevitably turn our eye to the riches that may lie deep within it. Uncovering them would change the economic landscape, as the accidental and unexpected discovery of oil on Earth did. But what is the interior of the moon like? To answer this, we have to consider the question, where did the moon come from? The origin of the moon has fascinated humanity for millennia. Because the moon rules the night, It has often been associated with darkness or madness. The word lunatic comes from luna, the Latin word for moon. Ancient mariners were fascinated by the connection between the moon, the tides, and the sun, and correctly ascertained that there is a close correlation between all three. The ancients noticed another curious fact. You only see one side of the moon. Think of all the times you've looked at the moon, and you realize you're always seeing the same face. It was Isaac Newton who finally put all the puzzle pieces together. He calculated that the tides are caused by the gravitational pull of the moon and the sun on the Earth's oceans. His theory indicated that the Earth creates tidal effects on the moon as well. Since the moon is made of rock and has no oceans, it is actually being squeezed by the Earth, and this force causes it to bulge slightly. At one time, it tumbled in its orbit around the Earth. Eventually, this tumbling slowed down, until the spinning of the moon was locked to the Earth, so that one side of it always faced us. This is called tidal locking, and it happens throughout the solar system, including for moons of Jupiter and Saturn. Using Newton's laws, you can also determine that tidal forces are causing the moon to slowly spiral away from the Earth. Its orbital radius increases by about 1.6 inches per year. This small effect can be measured by shooting laser beams to the moon. Our astronauts left a mirror behind to help with this experiment, and then calculating the time it takes for the beams to bounce back to Earth. The round trip takes only about 2 seconds, but this number is gradually increasing. If the moon is spiraling away, then by running the videotape backward, we can estimate its past orbit. A quick calculation shows that the moon separated from the Earth billions of years ago, and modern evidence indicates that 4.5 billion years ago, not long after the Earth was formed, there was a cosmic impact between the Earth and a large asteroid of some sort. This asteroid, which we call Theia, was about the size of Mars. Computer simulations have given us dramatic insight into this explosion, which gouged out a huge chunk of the Earth and propelled it into space. But because the impact was more of a glancing blow than a direct strike, it didn't take much of the interior iron core of the Earth. As a result, the moon, while it does contain some iron, has no significant magnetic field because it lacks a molten iron core. After the collision, the Earth resembled a Pac-Man, with a huge pie-shaped piece carved out. But because of the attractive nature of gravity, eventually both the moon and Earth condensed into spheres again. Evidence of the impact theory was provided by the astronauts who brought 842 pounds of rock back from their historic trips to the moon. Astronomers discovered that the moon and the Earth are made of almost the same chemicals, including silicon, oxygen, and iron. By contrast, random analysis of rocks from the asteroid belt shows that their composition is quite different from that of the Earth's. I had my own encounter with moon rocks when I was a graduate student in theoretical physics at the Berkeley Radiation Laboratory. I had a chance to view one under a powerful microscope. I was surprised by what I saw. There were tiny craters caused by micrometeors that had impacted the moon billions of years ago. Then, looking more closely, I saw craters inside these craters, and even smaller craters inside those. This chain of craters inside craters would be impossible in Earth rock, since these micrometeors would have vaporized while going through the atmosphere. But they could hit the lunar surface because the moon has no atmosphere. This also means that micrometeors could be a problem for astronauts on the moon. Since the composition of the moon is so similar to Earth's, the truth may be that mining the interior of the moon is only useful if you are building cities on the moon. It is probably too expensive to bring moon rock back to Earth if it only offers what we already have. But lunar material could be immensely valuable for creating a local infrastructure of buildings, roads, and highways on the moon. Walking on the moon. What would happen if you took off your spacesuit on the moon? Without air,